With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast. This time, we are coming from the Black Rock Drivers Club at the 2012 Goodwood Festival of Speed. We are surrounded by racing drivers and motorcyclists, so stay tuned, because during the next hour or so, we'll be talking to as many of them as possible. And we start, as we should, with our editor, Damien Smith, who is talking to Tom Christensen.
First guest, what a first guest to have. Tom Christensen, Le Mans legend. Welcome, Tom. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Well, so tell us first what you're driving this weekend.
The great privilege. I drive the Lotus T98, 1986. Senna drove this chassis, particularly chassis, it won twice. I believe it was in Jerez and in Detroit.
Detroit. I think he won, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the one where he narrowly beat at Mansell and in Jerez, and it has quite a lot of pole positions as well that year.
That's right. Yeah.
Awesome car to be driving. I mean, a Senna Lotus. How much horsepower are you running today?
Let's say it's not in qualifying trim, but it's a lot, and to feel it, it's really of the era when I was a kid in karting, dreaming about going into things like that. But that was and following that era where you say the engines were out of control, and that's really a fantastic era to drive, or to drive on a day like this. Let's say instead of a few years later where the aerodynamics were out of control. So the engine is mega. There's some turbo delay, but when it kicks in, you better be prepared.
That was always said in qualifying trim to have been probably the most powerful engine ever seen in Formula One, even more than the BMW. I think in 86, I seem to remember Peter Waugh saying they were sort of scraping 1,500 horsepower. You know, with the boost off the clock and the wastegate off and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it must have been an amazing time where you really had to. Nowadays, it's downsizing. It's about corner speeds. It's about things like getting the car in a perfect shape and perfect balance, so you are able to keep the maximum momentum. Back then, it was more, I can say, about
really
being really good on braking, and then get the car squared up, and then being put it in the direction, and then just go feed it. And of course, it's tuned down. There's no doubt that I feel that going up the hill now, but. It's a privilege to have felt a bit what Ayrton did when he went for these mega laps he did in that particular year.
Yeah, sure. Well, talking about the throttle lag, is it more than you expected?
Not really. It's actually, you feel it very easily on the revs. When you get to the revs about 9.3, 9.5, then it really kicks in. At that point, you are not looking at the revs anymore. You're looking at where you're going.
Yeah. Tom, while you're here, we've got to ask you about Le Mans just a couple of weeks ago. Really tough race, very close race. How do you feel about it now, a couple of weeks on from that second place?
I really think that we won second. I mean, Alan Dindo, myself, we did a really strong race. We were all prepared. We had driven, like the pre-test, Alan had new tires and got very good feeling with the car. Doing the qualifying at Le Mans, I had new tires, Dindo as well, but with a lot of fuel. So we were we all felt very good going into the race. Unfortunately, early on, we had an issue with a lot of rubber pickup building up on the right rear in the suspension, which compromised that area, and we had to take the car back into the garage really to fix it, and that was already after the fourth stint. So then we dropped back, not a lap, but by more than 2 minutes. So we were very determined, and I think everything really worked for us during the night. We did well, and in the morning I took the lead after the three stints. And since then, we were out of sync with the number one car and had a fantastic fight, but we looked very good. We had the advantage going up around lunchtime. And then Alan had the issue with the Ferrari. You know, that's the thing. With the unexperienced driver in a Ferrari gave this situation. And it's really tough. But I still believe getting the car back and from Alan and the mechanics did a great job. So we still won second. But yeah, we would really love to have done this one, because I think Audi showed, yeah, we have a strong competitor with Toyota. Very good preparation from them, and they did fantastic until they retired from misunderstandings as well. But we were racing, and I can see the four Audis, we were racing to the end. It could have been, and unfortunately it wasn't. But I still believe we did a very strong race, and we can be proud of that.
It was great credit to Audi to let you guys still go at it, because it would have been a pretty dull race after the Toyotas were out if it had been team orders. But you know, you were just allowed to go for it. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, we always are, but I mean, that just the race as it panned out, it showed that we were able to race, and you could see the drivers were on the limit. You saw Fassler being off. You saw Trelawney spinning into the pit lane. So you see everything was really, really on, and I think that is some situations which people listening are watching, they appreciate that.
Tom, after last year's accident, well, thinking about Rockefeller's accident last year, and then Anthony Davidson's this year, they were actually remarkably similar, weren't they? What led up to them?
Yeah.
I just wondered what if professional drivers, top drivers at Le Mans, are sort of starting to think maybe, you know, there are some guys in that race who perhaps should not be, and I know it's always been that way at Le Mans, but it's just having had two huge accidents in 2 years
in similar circumstances. I try to push in that direction. We should all be better. We can all be better. But when you approach in these two incidents, you have to look at the driver has not felt or seen the car behind, because he doesn't act like that. And in a professional driver will stay out wide, and he will maybe lose a few meters in the braking zone, but he will have the corner clear. And at the end of the day, he will lose less in the next 200 meters than he does with what now happened, or what even happened worse, obviously. But it's the thing is that you should expect a driver to see you when he is traveling in a GT car on a long straight. And there I see the issue. Of course, you have to be careful with taking corners, but a kink like this is not a corner. They can easily go or breathe it flat offline. But you need the trust there, and it's always happening. It is a driver who doesn't have the experience or the will or the control. It's a combination of that. So we need to have this better. I have pushed for it. I have asked why we cannot have something like more experienced drivers are getting around this of GT cars, and maybe they have to pass a sort of it doesn't necessarily need to be lap time. It also needs to be driving time in the car. It's a combination of both, because being slow is something, but it's also important to be aware, and it's the awareness we need to race, because that will help racing in generally. It's no problem when you come up to a professional, the Ferrari or the Corvette. We know that, and that is that works. But it's this one odd situation once in a while. There's a car with the green numbers, and we know that. But sometimes in the green numbers, it's even a pro driver in. But there's also two others needs more experience. But we are aggressive, and that's a combination of that.
Tom, we're aware you've got an appointment with that Senna Lotus on the hill, so we probably should let you go. And there's your teammates also hanging on to join us as well. So for now, Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Tom.
We continue with the Le Mans 2012 theme, and with us is André Lotterer. Thank you very much, André, for joining us on the Motorsport podcast. Fantastic. We just heard Tom talking about the potential dangers of some of the slower drivers. Do you have a view on what might be done about that?
Well, you know, in a way, that's what Le Mans is and what it's always been. And you know, we want to see a lot of cars on the grid, and it's and this is the compromise we have to live with. But of course, you know, since last year and this year, we saw some big accidents caused with drivers that are a bit less experienced, and of course, we don't like to see that because these are things that are avoidable. By just simply looking a little bit more in the mirror and understanding a bit more what's going on around you, you know, the things we could do is just to have more intense meetings for them that they're a bit more aware about it, and maybe also impose a check, some level, some like certain level, you know, that not just anybody can come and race. So yeah, maybe something in that direction would be not bad.
Andre, fantastic race this year, you know, thrilling battle between you and the number two Audi, almost right to the end. What was it like to be in the middle of all that? I mean, through the night and into Sunday morning, your teammate Marcel had some problems. Did you think the race was lost at that point?
It was intense, you know, and Le Mans is never over until it's over. So, I mean, you saw that, like, Alan had the accident just before the end, and it just proved that we were really fighting hard till the last moment. The race started flat out already, and then we had a nice fight with the Toyotas. They took the lead. I mean, it's quite impressive. They came in really strong. Unfortunately, they retired. I think it would have been a really nice battle. And then after they retired, it was a really strong battle between the number two car and us. And we had some lead, and I thought, okay, we just have to keep it going like that. It shouldn't be too much of a problem. But then Marcel had a little spin in the Porsche curves, and he touched a little bit. So as a precaution, he came in immediately, and I wasn't ready at all. I was eating upstairs, and I just hear on the radio, I touch. And then I ran down, put my helmet on, run to the car. Nobody in the car was there waiting. Just jump in, and I go, and I come out the pit, and Alan was right behind me. I just push hard, and I managed to get a little gap and enough to be able to split us from this with the safety cars. And then we had some air again, until Marcel, again, unlucky for him this year, but that time we really couldn't do anything about it. There was a Corvette in Mulsanne, and he had to avoid it, so we lost some time with changing the parts, and then Ben did some strong stints as well. So, but yeah, he was gonna really go down to the end because we were battling, we were a bit offset. Sometimes we were leading, they were leading. So.
Does it surprise you that Dr. Ulrich allows you to race just as if it were, you were racing a you know, cars from a different team? I mean, we all love it, but in a way it's sort of surprising.
I think he really cares about us, and he knows that if he would freeze the position early, we would not be happy, because he saw that we both have the potential to win, and he knows our nature, and if you do that to us, I think it's the worst thing you can do, because, you know, like, once they're in front, once the others are behind, so it wouldn't have been fair. But on the other side, it's quite brave for him
to
put cars like that at risk. But I think he does it because he trusts us, and he knows that you know, we have enough common sense, and that we he cannot take the race away from us. And it would have been also a shame for everybody watching the race, you know. Can you imagine, you would have frozen the position 10 hours to go or something, you know, just to bring the cars home. It would have not been fair. And but I have to say thanks to him, and it's fantastic that he trusts us that much.
Thank you very much, Andre. Thank you, and congratulations again. Great race.
Thank you very much.
Right, well, we move away from Audi just for a little while, and I should really tell you at this point, actually, that as we're in the Drivers' Club at the Festival of Speed, there is an awful lot going on here. I never realised there were so many racing drivers. They can't all be racing drivers. Anyway, it's pretty noisy, as you can probably hear. Marino Franchitti, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here. It was very interesting doing the experiments with you beforehand of finding out which microphone's very scientific of us.
I thought it might be a bit technical for you, actually, but we seem to have solved it anyway.
Yeah, well, you see, with the Nissan Delta Wing, it was like a rolling science experiment, so it's given me some good training.
Yes, I should have mentioned that, of course, the Nissan Delta Wing at Le Mans 2012, it's caused a fantastic stir, hasn't it? I mean, everyone's talking about it.
I've never seen anything like this in my motorsport career. Even being here at the Festival of Speed, I've been talking about it for 2 days now, and I must have signed 400 photos. Fans just keep coming with pictures of it. They want to talk about it, and like me, they wish it was here. So pretty disappointed that we couldn't have it here for the Festival of Speed, because the fans definitely want to see it.
Obviously, you were so unlucky not to drive in the race, but just give us some idea from your experience in practice what it was like to drive the thing and follow other cars.
A couple of very interesting things. Obviously, I was the main development driver of the Delta Wing, so I was doing all the testing from the first test all the way through. At Le Mans, a couple of things. It was over the crown on the Mulsanne. Normally, you've got to be so gentle as you cross over it, because the car, as you get to the crown, just darts over the other side. The Delta Wing was so stable down there, so easy. Just cross over it well, no problems. At Le Mans, you're always looking for a toe, even though you're running very limited downforce. You're always looking to get in the toe. You just pick up a couple of kilometres an hour, a little bit of fuel economy. The Delta Wing's so efficient on its own that getting a toe, all that was happening was our heads were getting ripped off by the dirty air, but the car actually was not accelerating at all. It's so efficient on its own that putting it into a toe doesn't do much. But the Porsche cars were fantastic. The aero is what has always been the most impressive thing of the Delta Wing for me, the grip that it has, considering it has no wings. The underfloor is very good. And it was just hauling the mail through the Porsche cars. Huge amount of fun.
I'm just trying to remember exactly the wording on the Dan Gurney's Christmas card last year. Was the car was a drawing of the car on the front of it, and the caption was something like, "Yes, but will it turn?" And I mean, the first time you drove it, you can see why, you know, everybody thought that. Well, will it turn? But the track as narrow as that, and you know, and everything else. But it apparently turns extremely well.
I'll never forget that. I thought, right, it's going to work, but how's it going to feel? Am I going to be able to access the performance? And I rolled out of the garage, and there was actually a chicane I had to go around to get on the track. So I thought, well, we're going to find out pretty quick. And it just changed direction so well. I was like, well, this is good. And there was a corner on the track that was third gear. And Ben said, in the simulations, if everything's right, low fuel, new tires, it might be flat. Third lap out, I was flat through there, pinned to the floor, pulling like 3.9G. And he's came in, he's giving me the, well, what are you doing? You know, take it easy. It's just a shakedown. I said, it just feels right, Ben. So yeah, and then he's explaining to me afterwards, we think we know what's going to happen, we're not really sure, but as a driver you have to have a lack of imagination anyway, so I just was getting on with it.
Marino,
forgive me, I was just going to say this, it staggers me that you, in three laps you were already that confident in how much turn in the car had.
It just, cars feel right or they don't within a lap, and it just I just felt things out. And there was a lot of runoff anyway, so I thought, we got to give this a go. But it just felt like that's what it wanted to do. And it very quickly, that first run, I already blew through the time that they thought the car was capable of there. Of course, we had a lot of ups and downs with the car. We had a lot of gearbox issues, which held us back right up until quite close to Le Mans. But this wasn't reheating the same old thing. This was completely reinvention, complete innovation. And for me as a driver, to get to experience what my heroes experienced in the 60s was the last time something like this happened. To work with Dan Gurney, to it's something that no one of my generation or the generation before that got to do. So I feel very fortunate to have had that experience.
I think we should say too at this point that Dan Gurney will be at the Goodwood Revival this year in September. And in fact, the meeting is largely sort of devoted to Dan. There'll be a special tribute to him every day with lots and lots of the cars he drove. And I know he's looking forward to it. And I tell you, a lot of people have been talking to us at Goodwood about, you know, how exciting this is. And And as you rightly point out, you know, he is a bit of a quiet man, Nigel, isn't he? You know, when you look at what he has contributed to motor racing and what he himself achieved, he's quite a quiet man for all of that, isn't he?
It's true. I mean, I think, but there was a whole generation of American racing drivers like that. I think, you know, I mean, Phil Hill was very similar. I think if you look at the span of Gurney's career and then just what he's done as a driver and as a constructor and everything else, I mean, it is fantastic. And he's 81 years old now. And I mean, when I talked to him about the Delta Wing, I mean, he was so excited about it, like it's half his age, you know.
You read my mind there. He comes alive. He's half his age, and to get out of the car after your first run to debrief with Dan Gurney, to then debrief after the event down at the workshop, hang out at AAR, and have Remy, who made the bubble on the GT42, make the dead pedal on our car. Same man, 91 years old, working 40 hours a week at All American Racers, to then have to send your report to Dan Gurney afterwards. It's just a dream come true. He also gave me a champagne shaking masterclass, which was pretty cool. So I know how to do it next time I get the chance, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Marino. Thank you.
You got a proper legend coming up next. So
you got a
beeper on that for bad language.
The great thing is we now know Marino Franchitti is a test pilot. So
Space Cadet,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. On we go then, and the beauty of being in the Black Rock Drivers Club is that every time we finish with one guest, another one appears. And this time it's, what can we say about John McGuinness? I know what we can say, yes. He has no brain and balls. He's just said so himself, and that's because, of course, he is a legendary motorcyclist. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, pleasure. Yeah, the big balls, by the way. But, it's great to be here. You know, I've done the Goodwood Festival of Speed many a times, and it's always fun, you know. We get to ride our bike up the hill. It's a bit greasy and a little bit different to the TT track, and once you get to the top, you want to go again. I must have done it 10, 12 times, and I've still no idea where I'm going up the hill. But, it's great to be here, and, I really enjoy my weekend, and we get to drink some champagne tonight and maybe hit the dance floor as well tonight. Perfect.
I've always wondered when you guys go up on those fantastic bikes, and bearing in mind what you do for a living, you know, what the real thing is, how much of a release is it just to do a wheelie, wave to the crowd? Because normally, you know, it must be 110% concentration every yard of every mile.
Yeah, for sure. At the Isle of Man, you know, when you're racing around there, it's 226 miles long. You're on the bike for an hour and 45 minutes. We have two pit stops, and each lap we do has 240 corners on it. So we have to have ultimate concentration, and our maximum speed is it's knocking on the door 200 miles an hour, just depending on wind direction and things. But 200 mile an hour and down to 20 mile an hour on the hairpins, and you know, the average lap record, the average speed, and I hold the lap record, is takes us 17 minutes and 12 seconds to get round, and it's 131.578 mile an hour. So I suppose our little sort of 45 second run up the hills a bit tame, really, but it's quite nerve wracking. There's a lot of people here, and it can easily go wrong at Goodwood. And we're trying to do a wheelie, and I'm not really a stunt rider, but we're trying to do a wheelie on a burnout or something, but it could go wrong and end up in the bales looking like a fool. But it's great, you know, like I say, it's no pressure, just have a little ride up the hill, have a wave at the fans and the kids and the families, and then get to the top and have a chat with everybody at the top. It's good, it's laid back and fun.
Hearing your description of a lap at the TT, I think we understand the no-braining big balls now, don't we?
John, I was going to ask, 20 or so years ago, just a bit less, Joey Dunlop did a lap, I mean you must have seen it, you know, with the camera. Has that ever been proposed more recently for you to do it? Because I mean that's mind blowing, but I mean,
yeah,
nothing like the speed you're doing now.
Yeah, I think that was 1983, so
it was,
maybe
yeah.
30 years ago. So
it was 83.
It was one sort of a, for sure, a video that gave me a lot of inspiration, really. As a kid, I watched it over and over and over and over again to learn the circuit, and like now you get a PlayStation, you get all sorts of bits and pieces with the Isle of Man TT track on it. But we actually do have high definition cameras on our bike, and It's weird that the cameras are that sharp now. It actually slows it down, and it's not as, like when Joey did it, it was a lot more violent and things. But and that was Joey did. I remember Joey did. He did 100. It was about 115 mile an hour average back then, 30 years ago, and we're doing 130 plus now. It looks much faster, but at the time it was a great video to watch. It was called V for Victory. It was called.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. The video. No, I watched it. I've played it.
I watched it so many times.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I'm not surprised. Yeah. You're a great mate of Mark Webber's, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I got pally with Mark over the last few years. He came to the Isle of Man TT to watch in 2008, and he wanted to meet a couple of riders, and he came into our awning, and you know, and I didn't really know Mark. I just knew that, you know, what he does and what he achieves on the F1 car. So we had a good old chat, and he was picking my brains about the course and the bikes and how bikes work, and you could tell. You know, the man was a complete enthusiast, and you know, he knew his stuff. And he was with his dad. His dad always wanted to go to the TT, and they were blown away by it. You know, they thought it was a fantastic thing to see. And you know, he pushes the word out there and gives us all a mention. And he came this year as well. And you know, I spoke to him the day before. I was really nervous about it, and you know, he sent me a real kind message about how to deal with it. And you know, he's an inspiring sort of character as well. You know, he's a very professional man, and trains hard, and you know, he wants to win. And when he came to watch, it was fantastic to win in front of Mark, in front of my family, in front of my sponsors and everything. So it was, but he really, really enjoyed it, you know. And, you know, over the last few years, we've just talked about a few things. He's a big Speedway fan as well. He loves the Speedway. And I'm a big Speedway fan. And, you know, he's a petrolhead at the end of the day. And he can relate to what he's talking about. And he's good fun to have around you.
John, the world, your racing world is very different to the Grand Prix world that we see on the TV every other week. What's your opinion of MotoGP from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the ultimate thing. You know, it's something I've actually tried. You know, I was in 1998, 99, and 2000. I was a British wildcard in the Donington in the Grand Prix. But you know, I rode a Honda V-twin two-stroke bike, and you know. To be brutally honest with you, I probably wasn't fast enough. You know, I tried my best, and I just couldn't quite run the pace of those guys. And you know, when you stood from the outside looking in, it looks easy to do, you know, but they are really special. I mean, obviously Valentino Rossi, Jorge Lorenzo, Pedrosa, these guys, they are gods. You know, they are unbelievable on what they do on a bike. You know, the speeds they're getting around, and you know, I tip my hat to them. You know, they're the best in the world at the moment. You know, I think they try and switch from class to class, the World Superbike, and back to MotoGP, but the MotoGP boys just stand out, and it's a good series. I'd like to see a few more bikes in there. They're trying harder a bit with this CRT, this claiming rules team, but they're sort of way off the pace of the prototype MotoGP bike, so it'd be nice just to freaking do something where all the bikes are on a bit more of a level playing field and give some more riders a bit more of a chance. But to go and see it, especially, it's Formula One of the two-wheel side, so yeah, it's pretty special to see.
Thank you, John. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Fantastic. John McGuinness. Okay, on we go. And thanks to our web editor, Ed Foster, who's very patiently standing next to us here. The supply of drivers is absolutely endless. Well done, Ed, I say. And Brian Redman, good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm all right, really, considering I got up too late after a rather late night and left the hotel, which is about 10 miles away, at 10 minutes to 9, and I was due on the hill at 10 minutes past 10, and it was all a bit tight.
tell us, Brian, what you're driving this weekend, please.
Well, I'm driving the famous Dan Gurney Eagle Formula One car with a Westlake engine, 1967 Spa-Francorchamps Belgian Grand Prix winner. And unfortunately, I think in shipping, coming from America, it suffered a derangement of the wheels, because one wheel is pointing out more than the other and the steering wheel isn't straight. And so it actually isn't really great to drive.
Yeah, that's a shame, isn't it? And I was saying to Nigel yesterday, actually, it is my favourite ever racing car of all time. It's so beautiful, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And, you know, I didn't know till today that the tub, you know, the main part of the monocoque is magnesium. Because they said to me, be very careful when you're getting out of it, where you put your hands, or the magnesium will crack. and all the suspension and the exhaust system is all titanium. I mean, it's an incredible piece of engineering. It's fantastic.
Oh. And in fact, I mean, it must have been an extraordinarily expensive Formula One car.
It must have been incredible.
You know, 45 years ago, yes. You know, compared with the other GP cars of the time, and yes. The way it was made, it was...
Well, it's got D. Gurney on the back of the gearbox cover, and I thought, that's funny, it looks a bit like a Hewland. So I said to Scott George, the curator for the Collier Museum, I said, why is it a Dan Gurney? Well, it is a DG300, which is the model number for the Hewland gearbox. Yeah. Dan Gurney 300.
So you can't really get any idea of what the car's like. I mean...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, I mean, the road's been slippery.
It sounds beautiful. Yes. That V12 always did sound beautiful.
Yes, it's great. The engine sounds fantastic. But in the first corner yesterday, and that's the first run, and it's the first time I've ever seen the car, never mind driven it, and, you know, I come into the first corner, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, boy, you were really trying at that first corner. And I said, yes, I was trying not to crash it.
So what else are you driving this weekend?
Nothing else.
Just the Eagle.
Just the car, just the Eagle.
Right,
And really, it's kind of a tremendously busy weekend, isn't it, all in all? Like last night, there was the dinner at Lord March's house, at Godwood House, and I literally left here at 6:30 in the evening, fought with all the traffic, got back to the hotel at 7:30, and at 7:20, I was back on the road coming back to Godwood House.
Brian, we know you're still very much involved in the scene over in America, and we were talking just before we came on air about that scene over there. There's nothing quite like Goodwood in the States.
No, and of course, you know, Bobby Rahal tried to start a series which would emulate Goodwood 2 years ago, and it didn't work. I mean, it is so difficult, and it's really impossible, because where else is there a Goodwood House, and where else is there a Lord March with all his incredible personal attention to detail? No, there isn't anywhere. I mean, you could have a really great event at Road Atlanta, where there's a lake, Lake Lanier. You could have wooden boats on the lake. There's an airport there. You could have the old planes flying in and out, but otherwise there isn't anything. No.
There's a big event in Road America coming up, isn't there, that you're attending?
Yes, that's in 2 weeks. Next weekend I'm at Le Mans driving an Alpha T33, and then on Monday I fly back to London Gatwick, stay the night, and fly to America on Tuesday, and we stay Tuesday night at the Hilton Garden Inn in Orlando, and on Tuesday morning our daughter Charlotte comes with our granddaughter Victoria, and Victoria and I fly off to Road America, and we have a party at David Hobbs's Honda dealership on Wednesday, and we're featuring the Lola, and especially the T70, and as of today we have 25 T70s entered for the event.
That's amazing.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We get 450 race cars, and we've got 25 to 30,000 spectators, so it's a great event. Yeah.
Brian, always great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much. I love your stockings and your outfit.
I knew that.
Yeah, but don't forget, in our day, they were suspender belts and suspenders, you know.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, but at the top of the stockings they had in Braille, "Far Enough."
Right, well, thank you, Brian Redman. And for clarification, he was referring to Rebecca, who is our sound engineer today. And Well, anyway, I think Brian gave you a clue as to how Rebecca is dressed today, and we'll leave it at that. Meanwhile, we have Emerson Fittipaldi, double world champion. This is fantastic. Thank you so much, Emerson.
Welcome.
Saw you out in the Lotus today. It gives me butterflies just to see it, actually, because, you know, it's, wow, all that time ago.
Well, it's a lot of a history today with 60 years of Team Lotus, Colin Chapman. I saw Hazel Chapman, Clive Chapman, all the Chapman family here. And I'm very proud to be a small history of this big history of Team Lotus. You know, I'm very proud to participate on the Lotus history with so many great champions, you know, since Jim Clark, Graham Hill, Jochen, I mean, you name it. Mario Andretti is fantastic names, and to be part of these great champions. And Colin was a genius to me. He was one of the best car designs ever. He was always ahead. He always innovation, trying to find the limit, over the limit, the extreme limit that not many people could find. And it was a great relationship with Colin. Peter Waugh, who was another great man in racing that I enjoy many years working together.
Nobody will ever forget the fact that you were winning a Grand Prix for Lotus less than 2 years after you first sat in a Lotus Formula One car. What on earth did that feel like at the time? That was spectacular, wasn't it?
Well, you know, it happened so fast, and I was in the right place with the right people, on the right team, and it just happened very fast. I only drove the Lotus 49 three Grand Prix, and then my fourth Grand Prix, first time with the Lotus 72, I won the Watkins Glen. I mean, it was a lucky win, but we were there at the end of the race. We were running strong at the end of the race. It was a tremendous pressure coming from the tragic weekend in Monza, and then being number one in Watkins Glen at the US Grand Prix. I was the third driver in Monza, and you know, Colin put a lot of pressure on me, the team put a lot of pressure on me, and I finished well the race.
And in fact, I mean, all the way through your career, right at the end of it, you still reckon the 72 was your favorite car, don't you?
Still, yes. For all the cars you ever drove,
yeah.
I could talk to the car would talk to me. We understand each other. And was incredible relationship when you feel the car is extension of your body and you're part of the car. Lotus 72 was very consistent. When you got right, end of 1971, we got working, and then was a fantastic car, 72, 73.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't that good in 71, was it, thinking about it? I mean, you had one or two good results, but it wasn't really a front runner in 71, was it?
In 71, we had a huge problem with the slick tires when it was the first year of the slicks. Improved the grip, and then the suspension was not taking all that load. And through the year, Colin decided to make a much stronger suspension. And then the car was reacting to the change, but we lost three quarters of the season with the slick tires, with more grip. We couldn't make the car work.
Emerson, if we thought you were busy then, boy, I reckon you're busier now, because I've just been told you've got to go.
Yes.
Anyway, you're driving again. Fantastic.
I'm driving again. I'll be driving the Lotus 72. I just drove the 49, and you know, it's so much history. And when you go back to this car, you know, the seat position, the pedals, the steering wheel is exactly like was. Even the smell of the car is the same. I mean, that's a fantastic memory.
Okay, Emerson, thank you so very much. And I've got to say, you're a great ambassador for our
thank
sport.
You
thank you. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Emerson Fittipaldi.
Thank you very much.
And you should know, everybody, by the way, that in next month's Motorsport magazine, I will be talking to Emerson Fittipaldi in a major feature about his thoughts, looking back on his career and also his thoughts about racing today. So that really is something to look forward to. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Straight on then. And Mr. Miracle Man, Mr. Foster, has produced none other than Jackie Eakes. Hello, Jackie. How are you?
Hi.
Fantastic to have you with us, and thank you for your time. It's difficult to know where to start with you, actually. So I think perhaps...
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is we could sit here all day talking about your career, but we haven't got all day, and nor have you. So can we start with, you know, what beautiful cars you're driving here at Goodwood this weekend?
Well, I'm driving a Porsche 917, a car which is coming from the museum. And usually when I come to Goodwood, Lord March always organizes great cars for me to drive, and he always tries his best to bring me into cars or I used in the past, or were very successful cars like the Ferrari 312 or other type of Porsches. And for us, basically, for all the drivers who are in the Goodwood Festival, most of the time it's opportunities to drive cars you have driven in the past, but also sometimes other very famous cars. For example, the Porsche 917, it's very attractive to me because I never drove one, because at the time I was in the opposition with the Ferrari 512. So it's really attractive. But more than that, of course, it's all about the soul of the Goodwood Festival, which is shared by everyone.
Sure, absolutely. And the theme of this year's Festival of Speed is Young Guns. And of course, a lot of people actually forget you were a very young gun when you first had success. I mean, I was looking at a picture of you yesterday. Things got very good for you very young, didn't they, Jackie?
Well, yes, we were young guns, because actually it's slightly different, but I have advocated with Nigel the start, and we mentioned, I mentioned many times, and as Nigel knows the story, we mentioned Ken Tyrrell. And I just say that without Ken Tyrrell, probably I would never became a professional driver. And in those days, yes, of course, racing was more dangerous than today. But that's not the final aspect. The final aspect is that in life, you have always to find somebody who believes in you, or trust in you, and who takes you by the hand and makes you grow. When we speak about Ken Tyrrell, definitely he is the man of my life. There is a number of them, but the key is really Ken Tyrrell. And Nora. I have to add Nora, because it was a team effort, always. Nora was part of the group. She was almost the coach of every driver who went through Ken's team. And it was a beautiful team, really.
Given how close you were, Jackie, to Ken, was there ever a chance of you driving in Formula One for Ken at all?
Well, I just say that Ken Tyrrell saw me in a race at Budapest, a street course with Cortina Lotus for Alan Mann. He decided that I could be a driver. But unfortunately, I was driving tanks in the Belgium army at the time, so I could not answer positively. The best thing I can say about Ken, a year later when I finished the army, he offered me to try single-seaters, and I just mentioned two. He really trusted me, because before the season started, I had already damaged a number of cars. That means not even racing. And I think today it's things are not acceptable anymore. But he really trusts that I could do it. And my first experience in single-seater, amazingly, is Goodwood. In winter 1965, where I spun at the chicane a number of times. And finally, I crashed on the at the king at the end of the straight. Well, you have to accept your mistakes, huh? You can't, not everything is beautiful, and it's, you can't hide facts, and the facts were that I was maybe fast, but rather unpredictable.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember Eamon telling me about the Nürburgring in 67, the German Grand Prix, when you were driving the Ken's Formula 2 car, and Chris was behind you in the Ferrari, and saying, finding it very, very difficult to keep up with you. But he said he was actually quite sort of frightened for you. He said every time he came around the corner, he was hoping you would still be there, because he just couldn't get over your sort of raw, just your raw speed. I mean, were you just too brave at that stage for your own good?
Well, I think the advantage of being young, you have no fear, and there is no mountain that you cannot climb. I have just to add that the advantage I had on everybody, that before going to the Nürburgring in Formula 2, I have done the Nürburgring 2 times at the 86 hours. So I had a mileage, I don't know what the mileage exactly, but I believe I had at least 300 laps on the ring, and I think nobody had that vision on the Nürburgring. Also, I have to add that driving a good Formula 2 at the time was much easier than driving a Formula 1 at the Nürburgring. 17 jumps with a Formula 2 is definitely much easier than doing it with a Formula 1 car. Yes, it's all about racing. You always fear, especially in those days where really Grand Prix were dangerous. But I'm still here, so maybe I wasn't quick enough.
Well, I mean, Jackie Stewart is still here as well, isn't he?
Yes.
And actually, I just wanted to ask you one thing. I asked Jackie recently, your entire career in motor racing, which was the most difficult corner, the most daunting corner, and he immediately said, Master Kink. Without a doubt. Would you agree with that or not?
When you speak about Spa-Francorchamps, definitely all the corners are really high-speed corner, and the Master's King for Jackie's bad memories.
Yeah, of course.
Because he almost had a fatal accident there, and it's only because he had a good guardian angel that it saved his life. But it's true to say that in 72, I believe, I did in practice the highest speed on a road course with a Ferrari 312.
Yes, yeah.
And that speed was, by memory, 263 kilometer per hour average on a road course.
Right, right.
And nothing has been done before.
Yeah.
Now I go to the point, because you mentioned Master. At the exit of the Master King, there was a 307 kilometer per hour, because I checked the gears,
Jesus,
the revs, and all the corners at the time were about 270, 280 to reach the average.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Considering you have La Source, so it's very slow.
Yeah.
You have Le Redillon,
Eau
Rouge.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like today, flat out.
No,
was really a corner.
Yeah.
It was fast.
And the thing about the Master Kink as well was it was a downhill approach, and it was blind as well. That was the other thing, wasn't it? And you look at it now and you think, they were taking this flat, or almost flat. That, how is that possible? Because it's a left-hander and a right-hander.
Well, that you have to... That's the difficulty about the option, is to resist to the temptation to lift, even slowly. Because sometimes drivers say, I'm flat out.
Yeah.
But between flat out and just giving a little lift on the pedal, it makes a hell of a difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people have admiration for us at the time. But the other day I drove an Auto Union from 19, the C-Type, from 1938. The C-Type at Francorchamps was running around 320 kilometers per hour in 1938. Narrow wheels, very narrow, almost bicycle wheels, suspension limited, no brake assistance, no steering assistance, no belt, no helmet, no nothing. full of ethanol. These drivers at the time really deserve a big, big, big respect, because when you have driven the C-Type, you know what you're talking about. And then you just try to put that into 1938 compared to the modern times where you're cruising with safe car. What these drivers like Rosenmeier, these Caracciola, these Stuck did before the war, it's so unbelievably impressive. And that makes me think that at the revival next September, I think Audi and Mercedes will bring a number of silver arrows. We hope to go to a number of 8 if they're all running at that moment, plus few cars of the era, Bugattis and everything. And I believe that it's going to be an incredible grid that nobody has shown before. And I think that's going to be attractive. Of course, it's not going to be a race, but it's going to be a demo. But you will get the sound of the 16 cylinder, the 12 cylinder. And it's going to be amazing.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because you know, that's going to be something not to miss, I think. People will look back on it, I think, in years to come and say, you know, were you there? Did you see it? Yeah.
It's going to be unique for sure. Only the grid already is going to be fantastic. I mean, the picture is going to be very impressive.
Just lastly, Jackie, can I ask you, yesterday I was watching the Ferrari 312 warming up alongside the 2011 car in the assembly area. And I wondered if you thought that driving then was actually easier in some ways than driving now, bearing in mind the amount of technology that these guys are dealing with, or whether you think it was the opposite, it's a bit easier now. Do you have a view on that?
Well, I have many views on that. Era, pre-war, after-war, 70s, very often it's called piece of bravery, because cars were not very strong, safety on race courses were very limited. But that's the limit. I think cars were simple in a way to adjust and easy to drive. I think modern racing is very, very complicated. These drivers who drive these modern Formula One cars today are not only talented by their driving skill, but also you have to have the possibility to be concentrated on the track, but at the same time you have to be able permanently to modify either the quantity of fuel or adjust this. You have roughly eight buttons on the steering, and you do that when you already concentrate. And I think frankly it's very difficult. These cars there, physically it's hard, but they have all the assistance, it's easy to shift, you do it with the fingers, okay. But the pressure is so high because you have to be able to do many things at the same time. So I think only a very limited number of drivers can do it, and that includes really the full grid. Modern racing, it's really difficult in my opinion. That's going to be my answer.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jackie X. Thank you for joining us today. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Right, well, we're nearly at the very end, sadly, of our Motorsport Magazine podcast here at the Black Rock Drivers Club at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. And I must say, it's been absolutely fantastic. So thank you, Ed Foster, very much for bringing us all our guests. And we close the show with Karen Chandock, and who I don't think needs a huge amount of introduction, but of course, Formula One with Lotus. And a very, very, very natural broadcaster, if I may say so. Sort of duck to water stuff, isn't it? How are you feeling, you know, now looking back, and I guess you're looking forward, but how are you feeling about the whole Formula One thing now?
Well, you know, I don't think it's yet time to be looking back. As you rightly said, I'd love to be back in Formula One and racing there, but I think the business is very different to how it was a few years ago. You know, the teams today, the way they need to look at drivers for commercial backing and things like that makes it a bit difficult sometimes for drivers. So We'll see. I mean, I'm starting to get into sports car racing a bit more now. I mean, I'm enjoying it, especially Le Mans 2 weeks ago was an amazing experience. You know, it's one of those boxes that I knew I always had to tick in my career. I didn't think it'll happen so early, but yeah, along with Monaco, Indianapolis, Bathurst, Macau, you know, Monza, Silverstone, Spa, you know, there's some circuits you have to do in your career, I think, to make it complete. And to finish sixth at Le Mans, I mean, we had four Audis in front of us, so to be second in the privateers, I was very happy with that for my first attempt. So, yeah, it's life is interesting at the moment.
And it was with a team new to Le Mans. You had two experienced teammates in David Brabham and Peter Dumbreck. What was it like being with those guys?
Well, they've got 23, or they had 23 Le Mans between them before last weekend, and neither of them could find scrutineering on the way to. So they still needed me to look at the map to find where it was in the town. Yeah, obviously they've both done a lot, and I was very happy. The team seemed quite pleased with the job I did. I was just as quick, if not quick, a bit quicker in the race. So, but there's so much to learn from those guys. Obviously, you know, Brabs has been around. It's really funny. I took a picture of the silk cut Jag that I'm driving here at Goodwood and sent it to him. I didn't realize he actually raced one of those cars back in the day. So, yeah, it's been great. I mean, I think it's a good balance of. I think I'm still coming from a Formula One mentality where we're quite selfish and we're quite, you know, you want things done for you rather than you forget that everything has to be done by committee in with three drivers. So I still have a little bit of F1 mentality. I'm shouting and screaming a lot more. But I think we bring about a good balance between the three of us.
What did you actually think of the circuit itself, Le Mans?
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, again, it's an old school circuit. I think I'm a little bit like Nigel. I like the old school circuits where there's a little bit of danger in it. I'm not a big fan of big tarmac runoffs, and you know, I think circuits should have grass and gravel and walls, and you know, that makes it a challenge. And you want to see drivers punished for mistakes, even if it's me. You know, I think. And Le Mans an old school circuit. You know, it's one of those places. It reminded me a lot of Monza. When you arrive, you know, you feel the history. You look at the walls and the pit buildings, and you just, it's got character. It's got soul. And you know, I'm not a big fan of going to places like Abu Dhabi and Bahrain and stuff. I think its facilities are great for the teams, and yeah, you got air conditioning and all that. But it's not the same, is it? It's just not the same.
No, it's absolutely not the same. No. Karun, I just wanted to ask you how, being in a sports car and having two teammates, I always wonder about people, with, as you say, with a Formula One mentality, suddenly having to get used to the fact that they also have responsibility to, you know, it's not just you. And I wondered how easy or otherwise it was to make that. Leap.
It's very tricky because it starts with even just sitting in the car, because the seat is not made for you. You know, you have to share the seat with two other people, and I'm the shortest one. So, for example, I can't reach the heel rest. So I'm, you know, my legs sort of just hanging there. When you're doing a quadruple stint at Le Mans without a sort of rest for your legs, it can be quite hard work. I'm on my tippy toes, you know, to reach the pedals. So. But, you know, it's just part of the challenge, I think. And I mean, the bigger challenge is from an engineering point of view, because I'm used to, you jump out of the car, you interact with the engineer and say, right, I want this and this done to make me go quicker. And all of a sudden, nobody moves because you have to talk to the other two guys as well. So that's a bit tricky. But I think we're quite fortunate that we all seem to want the same things from the car. We all have similar feet. I mean, I think the only thing is I can deal with the car, move a bit looser on the rear, maybe than the other two. But apart from that, we generally wanted the same things, which is fortunate for the team.
And we've got to ask you about that Jag you've been driving today, the Group C car. I mean, you know, you famously have an understanding and an appreciation of history. And what a great sports car to drive. What's it been like?
Amazing, you know. First of all, to imagine that down the Mulsanne Strait in the middle of the night is just mad. It's got so much power compared to what we have today. You know, I would say if we went to an airfield, did a straight line drag, that car would leave my HPD Honda standing. You know, it's got the torque. It's a 7.5 liter engine. normally aspirated, but it's got so much torque. It's unbelievable. But it's very difficult to get a feel through the corners because there's no temperature here. You know, we haven't got blankets, and it's quite a short run. So unless you get temperature, it's hard to feel through the corners. So yeah, it was a bit scarier than when I drove that Williams. I came here with 2010. It was warmer in 2010, and I drove the 82 Williams. And that I could start pushing, you know, because the temperature would come quite quickly, and it was a hotter day. So this was a little bit scarier, but still. I mean, I was in second gear, wheel spinning all the way up the straight past the crowd up here. So brilliant, really good.
Karen, thank you very, very much. I must say, it really is, it's always a pleasure to see you because you have so much enthusiasm and passion for the sport in general and for events like this. So thank you very much. Fantastic.
No, thank you. I mean, I'd love to come back next year. And I've told Jonathan Williams, one day I will drive that Williams FW15C that's parked down size. That'll be my dream. So hopefully I'll come back again for that.
Right. Well, sadly, that's all we have time for. We could have gone on all afternoon and probably all night, actually. But many thanks to BlackRock for letting us into their exclusive Drivers Club at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. And thanks also to our very own Ed Foster, who brought us our guest today. And thanks too to Rebecca, who's been our sound engineer today. Quite a demanding job, actually, because...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As you can probably tell, it's pretty noisy in here. Anyway, I very much hope you've enjoyed it. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.